Money Radio. Thank you for joining us. Pleasure to welcome Shane Snow. He is a journalist and an entrepreneur and an author. New book, Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Smart Cuts by Shane Snow. Shane, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
First question has to be, what's the difference between a smart cut and a shortcut?
Well, the main difference I see is that shortcuts can be amoral, right? It's a shorter way of doing something, but often it takes value away. I think of smart cuts as alternate paths than the conventional way of doing things, but that ultimately get you places faster without negative externalities, I guess.
Give us an idea of that difference between the two.
So the book is based on a bunch of stories of rapid successes throughout history, from kind of days past to days present, and I go through patterns in how both entrepreneurs and smart inventors take these kinds of different paths. One very well-known example that I kind of just jab at a little bit in the book is Apple. So they're known for being very innovative, but one of the questions that, you know, comes up is why. You know, what do they do differently? And one of my favorite examples is, you know, computer mice, like the mouse that you use to control a computer.
Mm-hmm.
There was this period of time when innovation, in quotes, in computer mice was about adding more buttons, making them bigger, more ergonomic, and sort of this arms race of, it's not a five-button mouse, it's a six-button mouse. Apple went the other direction where they decided they were going to make a zero-button mouse. They made a mouse that has no buttons. It's not very ergonomic. It's just a piece of glass, essentially. And overnight, they doubled their market share with this product that was so different. It was opposite of what people expected them to do. And you see that pattern in all of their products. Things get simpler, radically simpler, and they tend to, I guess, zig when the rest of the world zags. And it's very deliberate. So that's a tiny example that I think a lot of people can see in mainstream culture. But you see this pattern throughout people from Ben Franklin to, you know, Elon Musk, the guy that has built the first successful private space company. The way they think, the way they approach problems is often very different than kind of the rules that everyone set up for how you're supposed to do things.
So simplicity may be part of the idea behind innovation, but that's been around for a long time. I mean, we can
Absolutely.
Go back to the idea of the simplest solution is the best solution. That was the old Occam's razor. And,
mm-hmm.
and that goes back at least hundreds of years.
Yeah, and Picasso, right? His a lot of his work was great because he would take, you know, the very complex figure and turn it into a series of just simple lines, right? And that was, but that was really different in his time. The thing that you're getting at, though, is one of the things that fascinated me is we talk about another cliche is the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. What you see in especially very successful, rapidly successful people's career paths is they often don't take the straight line approach. And the thing that I like to say is if everyone's standing in the straight line, sometimes the fastest way is to actually take the long route. You see this in one of my chapters. I talk about the unconventional career paths of U.S. presidents. And when you look at the data, you find that, fascinatingly, the best presidents that were the most successful, as ranked by historians, that got the most accomplished, tended to not have spent much time in Congress. They didn't climb the straightforward political ladder, you know, starting as a state senator, junior congressman, senator, vice president, president. The people who ended up being the most successful actually came from other careers, like the military or business or philanthropy or, you know, Hollywood. And when you look at the other way, the presidents that spent the most time paying dues, you know, spending 30, 40 years in Congress, actually ended up being fairly terrible presidents from a statistical standpoint, not everyone. And so you see that pattern a lot in successful CEOs, for example. The youngest Fortune 500 CEOs tend to be either entrepreneurs or they switch from other companies rather than doing what the advice that we're given in high school and college, which is, get an entry-level job, work hard, keep your head down, get experience, you know, be patient and pay your dues. And it turns out that some of the most successful people actually completely ignore that, and they switch careers, they switch paths multiple times, and that ends up accelerating both their time to success and to get the top, but also their ability to be flexible, which is really what makes for a great leader and a great manager or successful business person.
That segment on the presidents really was rather interesting. Most presidents are elected at an earlier age than the typical age of a senator. How did these folks jump ahead?
You know, it's crazy because I also looked at the people who lost the presidential elections, and they tend to be the same age. There's something about when you get to the point that you can become president, that you're a viable candidate, on average, these people end up being either younger than the average senator or having spent less time if they're older. You know, so presidents like Reagan, for example, he'd spent very little time in politics before he got to the top. It used to be in the 1800s that Congress was sort of this up or out kind of game. You became, you know, a member of Congress and you spent a couple of terms, and either you moved forward, you sort of vied for the president or vice presidency, or you were out and you went back to, you know, whatever you were doing before, law or business. And it turns out that in the last 100 years, it's actually become more of this kind of pay your dues game, where it's all about how much time you spent and seniority and committees you're on, and it's this whole sort of web that you get pulled into, and that's why there's, you know, these shows like House of Cards that are so popular now are so interesting, because it gives you a highly dramatized snapshot of what life is like inside of the political realm, and really it's this game that people play, and what you find is that people that make it to the point where they could become president often play a different game than everyone else is playing. They tend to come from sideways or come from out of nowhere, or they rise very quickly, and they don't follow the same rules that everyone who's sort of slogging it out in Congress do. The reason why everyone doesn't catch on to this, I don't know. And, you know, certainly some people just want to represent their state and they don't have ambitions of moving forward. But if you really ask every senator, every congressman, they're in politics for a reason. They want to move up. They wouldn't say no to the shot of moving higher in general. So there's something about this flexibility that makes for really great leaders or really great political climbers. The ability to be agile and jump sideways actually is much more beneficial than the ability to sort of stay the course and be stalwart and patient.
Of course, the other thought perhaps is that people who have been in politics for a long time pick up some bad habits and some bad luggage along the way. So
absolutely.
There are a lot of other ideas that have been tried over time to try and make a smart cut or a shortcut in one's career, if you will. The idea of mentoring, of course, and you talk about that in the book as well.
Yeah, so one of the common advice, what I try to do with almost every chapter, is look at a common piece of advice about success and then deconstruct who are the most rapidly successful in various industries and do they follow this advice. So the advice you get on mentorship is it's not what you know, it's who you know that helps you get to the top. And, you know, everywhere from, you know, the old days of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and Alexander the Great, you know, the great patterns of so-and-so mentored so-and-so, and that's why they were successful. You see that all the way down to pop culture. You know, Star Wars, there's Obi-Wan Kenobi and the Karate Kid, there's Mr. Miyagi. It appears that having a master teacher who's been there before, who's been on the path before you, helping you, accelerates your success. What happens, though, is when you look at the academic research on mentorship programs, is at a net effect, mentorship doesn't actually end up helping people, you know, at a macro level in terms of future salary, career growth, even, you know, whether or not they'll stay out of jail. And so that it's troubling that the statistics show that mentorship doesn't actually provide much benefit. And so the question that I asked is well, how do it appears that it seems that mentorship does have some sort of effect. How do you make mentorship work and actually accelerate your career? And the main story I look at is Jimmy Fallon, who is a very talented comedian. He got on SNL after having been in comedy for only a couple of years, and he didn't know anyone. He was this bumpkin from upstate New York. You look at him now, you say he clearly deserves the success he got, but he didn't know anyone. He didn't really have a mentor starting out, and he got there much quicker than a lot of his peers. And so what did he do that allowed him to get to where he did and to get the success he deserved, rather than so many people who are talented just can't get recognition and can't get spotted. And so what he did was actually a very clever twist on mentorship that I don't want to ruin the surprise of the book because it's a fun chapter. But suffice it to say that in mentorship, for mentorship to be really effective, it has to go beyond just helping you practice. It has to go beyond being just a teacher, you know, teaching you the karate moves, but actually having a mentor that guides your journey in the long run, where you can have vulnerability and care about your lives rather than just caring about learning a skill or mastering a trade, which is usually what happens with mentorship programs. You bring people in to, you know, teach you a skill, to kind of be there for you in the short term. That doesn't really do much. You can watch YouTube videos and learn the same skills. But when you have someone that's guiding your journey for years and years and is in it for, you know, sort of as much your emotional success as your sort of career and economic success, that ends up being a very powerful boost on someone's career across industries.
One of the things about Fallon, and I don't think that this really, is a spoiler alert, but he was intensely focused on the singular idea of being on Saturday Night Live. And everything that he was doing for several years in his life was leading to that point, so much so that when he actually got on Saturday Night Live, it was kind of a what next kind of an idea. He had achieved what he set out to do and did it at a fairly young age.
Yeah, that obsession is, you see that a lot. I mean, his classmates at school were memorizing, you know, statistics about football players, he was memorizing, you know, the way Hollywood worked and studying the careers of these great comedians. And yeah, that was his singular goal. And he also did something really interesting where when he initially set out to get SNL, he was aiming really high. You know, this young kid, it takes decades for people to get to that level. And he had hardly been on a stage. But his goal when he went for his second audition to SNL, the one that he eventually got called back for, was not to get SNL, but to make the showrunner of SNL, Lorne Michaels, laugh. And he's this notoriously sort of stone-faced in auditions. He's not going to laugh when you audition in front of him. And that was Jimmy's goal. He was so obsessed with, can I just make this guy laugh? And he studied so hard. And I think that level of love and passion definitely made the difference. I mean, everyone who's in comedy would love to be on SNL, but Jimmy made this his life dream since a kid, and I think that definitely made a difference.
Interestingly, for many people, just a singular focus is not the answer. For many people, they're climbing along on whatever ladder they're on, and for them, maybe the best thing is to jump off that ladder and jump onto a new one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. There's a little bit of irony there. And that's something that I grappled with when writing the book in my intellectual adventure of deconstructing these stories and this research, is that there appears to be a conflict between that big vision and the path to getting there often being more jagged and zigzaggy than you would expect. And the other thing, too, is when you think about innovation often happens, almost always happens, when you have disparate things bumping into each other. You know, when you have insiders in one field that are so used to the rules and conventions of an industry, change doesn't happen very rapidly. But when you bring in wild cards, that's when change does happen. I think in Jimmy's case, part of what helped him be successful is he was coming from outside of Hollywood. He's coming from kind of nothing and not really understanding how the game was played. And therefore, he played a different game, and that helped him be successful. So there is an element of that sort of sideways movement to his story, even though he had this singular focus.
There are some other ideas and smart cuts. And by the way, there are a lot of stories in the book, and they kind of flow together. And just a warning, when you pick it up, it's hard to set it down. The book is Smart Cuts: How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Smart Cuts by Shane Snow. Shane Snow is our guest today, and we will continue our conversation in just a moment. Money Radio. Radio. Thank you for joining us. We're talking about Smart Cuts. That's the new book by Shane Snow. Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. There are many ways. One might be climbing a ladder, jump over to a different ladder. There may be a singular approach. Maybe there are mentors involved. But all along the way, I'm sure, this is another important aspect, people get feedback on what they're doing. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative, but it is a learning experience for everyone who receives any kind of feedback. What kind of feedback is the most effective in leading to success and innovation?
Well, when you look at the research, you see that negative feedback, critical negative feedback, is much more helpful in accelerating our success and helping us learn and to change than positive feedback. So you did this wrong is more helpful than good job, you did this right. The thing, though, is when we're new to a field or before we're confident, it's very hard to take negative feedback the right way. What you have to have is what psychologists call a feedback mindset, where you have to decouple the feedback from being a commentary on you intrinsically and the commentary on your performance. So this is why Olympic athletes, they love hearing negative feedback. They love to know what they did wrong. They don't care about the praise. But when you're starting out at a sport, it's very demoralizing to get negative feedback. And one of the examples I sort of throw out there in the book is if you've ever went bowling, and if you're like, and you're a terrible bowler, everyone tells you what to do. You need to twist your arm, and you need to step like this, and keep your eyes on the pins. And all of that feedback makes you so self-conscious that you end up throwing the ball in the gutter. And you see this in all sorts of industries, from, you know, heart surgeons learning surgery and getting better or worse based on the feedback they're getting. But the idea for accelerating your success is to turn failure into feedback, make it so that there's no catastrophic outcome if you do something wrong, and then to depersonalize it. So making it so that the feedback is not affecting you personally, which is very hard to do. And I give several stories in the book about how, you know, one of my favorites is the Second City Comedy School, how they take these young aspiring comedians who are very nervous to get on stage, and they train them in a very quick amount of time to take very harsh feedback. No one's laughing at your joke, and turn it into something that you can use to make better jokes.
We've talked about innovators. You've given us an example here today about Apple. We've talked about icons. Jimmy Fallon, the comedian, is one. Second City, another great comedy troupe. That's another example of icons. But the book is titled Smart Cuts, subtitle, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. What about the hackers? And we just have about a minute here.
So hackers are, you know, known as being computer breakers, right, criminals, but the original connotation for hacker was more like the MacGyver idea. How do you take pieces that don't fit together and make something work? You know, use duct tape to build a rocket. In the book, I talk about some hackers that actually use hacking, like the pirate radio that they used in the Cuban Revolution to win the war, but also about people who built things out of obscure pieces and obscure items. And that's what I mean by hackers. One of the things I wanted to do is to show that the hacker mindset, the hacker thinking, can be used for good as much as it's, you know, used for ill, especially in popular culture. And that by teaching our kids to think more like hackers in the less nefarious sense, we will get more progress and more innovation than we think possible.
Give us a quick example of hackers successfully doing that.
Sure. So the example that comes to mind, you ever fill out those crazy letters when you're trying to buy tickets online? They're called a CAPTCHA.
Yeah.
So this is a security method. What you're actually doing when you fill those out is you're helping to transcribe old books from old libraries into digital. So these old books from these libraries, so they photocopy them, but they can't search them with a computer. They have people actually fill them out. So that's a good way of hacking, I guess.
Okay. Smart Cuts by Shane Snow. As I say, it's a well-written book, and you pick it up, and it's just hard to set it down. Smart Cuts, How Hackers, Innovators, and Icons Accelerate Success. Smart Cuts by Shane Snow. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you.